My question is, I know immediately your concerns are dealing with the individuals who are currently being targeted, subpoenaed, and so forth. But as you're talking, I'm wondering, it seems like there's some strategic game going on where you have law people and lawmakers and so forth on the government side sort of winning this battle to shape the rules to get power. And I'm thinking that it seems that there could be some sort of an effort rather than just playing the defense of defending the people as they get caught and, you know, snagged here, to sort of proactively look at these rules. I guess people try to, but it seems like what kind of efforts can be made to rewrite some of the rules?
After the humanitarian law project decision came out, there was an effort and a continuing effort to go back to Congress to change the material support law, to make it more specific that it doesn't concern First Amendment advocacy work. Because it's very vague in the law itself. If you look at all the things they consider material support, most of them have to do with military-type support, communications, safe houses, weapons, and none of this. So the idea would be, say, just like they exclude medical support and religious articles to exclude First Amendment support. But, of course, we have a new Congress, which is unlikely to be sympathetic to that change in the law. So that's one thing. There's also been, for years, efforts to change the grand jury to make sure that the grand jury does not target people who are involved in First Amendment activity and can't even ask about First Amendment activity. I have argued and written about a political right of silence. If you are called before a grand jury and you can make a colorable case that the questions they're asking you has to do with your First Amendment associations or activities, you shouldn't be required to testify about them. Again, we have not been successful in getting Congress to change the grand jury law as to that. So those are the affirmative kinds of things that can be done. The other thing that Sarah and others are doing is trying to get support and political pressure to stop the grand jury and to stop the... What we're looking at here is a grand jury and potentially people being locked up, but beyond that, people indicted for providing material support for a Palestinian organization, and they're also talking about the Colombian organization, and trying to petition or write letters to the U.S. Attorney and the Attorney General and the President calling for him to, you know, back off of this. That's a very difficult thing as well.
I don't know, Mr. Meyer, did you have anything?
No, I would just echo what Michael said. I think one of the primary ways we're trying to address this, like Michael said, is through the legislature. There's several ongoing lobbying efforts, and I would encourage people to consider contacting their congressman and expressing concern about the state of the material support law right now, because, like I said, we do feel it unduly impacts our First Amendment rights, and we need to do something about that.
Would it be fair to say that government's interest in Sarah's trip really is not that she took a trip, but the government, from its the warrants that it issued for the subpoenas, is interested in finding evidence that there was material aid to the so-called foreign terrorist organizations. And so they've been looking into Freedom Road Socialist Organization and different groups. And they're trying to get information from Sarah that would be evidence of who organized it and how they organized it, and whether there was contact with so-called foreign terrorist groups. That is not really a harassment of the travel, but that you're trying to find the evidence for this material support.
I mean, you know, obviously if she traveled to Barbados, they wouldn't be, you know, looking into her travel. So it's not because of her travel, it's because where she traveled. And if you go to the Middle East, you have all these non-governmental organizations who may or may not have people who are affiliated with some of these groups. There are four or five Palestinian groups on the government list. I would say they make up 80% of the political groups in Palestine or the occupied territories. And then there's all these non-governmental organizations. So basically what they're doing is trying to find out all who was involved with the trips, yeah, who met with the trips, who she talked to, and that all is creates a very chilling effect. Who wants to go on a trip if they feel like they're going to be questioned by the government? So it may not be, you could argue that their intent, the government's major intent, is not to chill these trips or not to prevent people from coming back and educating American people about what's going there. But that's the effect of it, and that's why we have a First Amendment, right, basically. So people are able to travel and speak out and associate freely. So I would argue to you that the whole effect of these type of subpoenas is to chill First Amendment activity.
I think Michael said earlier that the prosecutor was exercising the grand jury. The prosecutors were exercising privileges that belong properly to the jury. Is there any possibility of using that difference or displacement against the system?
We've tried to ask the judge to instruct the grand jury of what their rights are. In other words, somehow break through, pierce that veil that belongs between the U.S. attorney and the grand jurors. Because, like I said, no lawyer ever can go in a grand jury room, a defense lawyer. And that we haven't been successful. But I think it is a question of trying to educate the grand jurors about what their rights are vis-a-vis the prosecutor. The problem is that they bring the grand jurors in, they sit for maybe a month or 2 months, they maybe meet once a day or once a week, and 90% of the cases they deal with are regular criminal cases. And they go through them one after another, bringing indictments. Then they have this case, and they may just submit two or three hours of information to the grand jury on this case over 6 months, two or three hours a week, okay? The grand jurors, they're just hearing it. They don't really know. And then at the end of it, they'll come in and make a presentation to the grand jury. We've told you this, we've told you this, we told you this. This is the indictment we want you to return.
I was on a grand jury.
Okay, so you know.
But we did stop an indictment. This is 30 years ago.
Okay, good for you.
If you do appear in front of the grand jury and hypothetically answer all of their questions, what is the chance that they're going to turn around and then charge you and the other individuals that you traveled with crimes? And, like, basically, what's the process after the grand jury?
Usually, if you're called before a grand jury and given immunity and answer all their questions, usually you're not going to be indicted, okay? Obviously, if you go in there and tell them something that makes them think you're involved in what they're investigating, they can't use what you say, but now they know, and they go out and get some other information to indict you. So you can actually be... Just because you go in there and answer all their questions honestly and freely doesn't mean it's the end of it. They could say, wow, this person told us this. We can't go in court and say that, but now we know what they're involved in, so we'll go out and get other information and charge them. So they could be charged. They try to avoid that because it makes it more difficult for them. They try to avoid giving immunity to people who they really want to indict, but not always.
Can I just clarify too that Michael's, the idea that they can't use what you said against you only applies after you're given immunity. If you go in there and you just say, just answer the questions before you're given immunity, then they can use whatever they want to charge you with whatever they want.
Actually, I just wanted to let people know about two trips to Israel and Palestine. If you're wanting to take such a trip, you can go to two websites. One is www.neighborseastandwest.org, all strung together, neighborseastandwest.org. The other one is with the Common Bond Institute, and their website is CBI, for Common Bond Institute, cbiworld.org, and they will be ending their trip with a conference at Neve Shalom in Israel. And those trips are both in June, and they're, as I understand it, relatively inexpensive and designed specifically to create the kind of awareness that you were trying to encourage people to have.
Sorry, that wasn't a question.
I had a question about the how grand jury members are selected and how they keep people that are going to object to this process off the grand jury, and if they get on the grand jury, how they can sideline them, or if you object, does there have to be a majority for an indictment?
Yeah, they need they have to sit with a quorum. There's 23 usually sit are for a grand jury, and they need a majority of the people present to vote an indictment. The grand jurors are chosen the same way petit jurors are chosen, from the voter rolls, or in some instances they're now supplementing them with driver's license or electric bills. But they're just picked from the same rolls as the regular jurors. They're not any special role for them. And I would think if you go in the grand jury and raise a lot of problems for the prosecutor, he'll figure a way to get rid of you.
This question is for Sarah. There were just three of you who went on this trip, or there were more of you?
There were more of us.
And you three were selected because you are Jewish and they are Palestinian-Americans?
I don't know if that's why we were selected. We were also the youngest ones on the trip. I'm 24. And the two of them are also in their early 20s. We're all recent graduates from college. I would assume that partly because we're younger, they thought that we would be easily, you know, intimidated to go and testify. So that could have been a reason. I'm not sure. I mean, there's also, they could also continue to subpoena the people that we traveled with. I'm not sure if they will or not.
So we can't make a case for selecting the three of you on those two narrow categories.
Well, I mean, it's all speculation. I have no clue. I mean, we weren't told specifically why.
Was there, in this humanitarian law project, has there been, you said it was a, they asked for an adjudication about the law, I guess the vagueness of the law, but it hasn't actually been applied to them. So has there been any further action by the government about any of their activities since that Supreme Court decision?
I think those people who brought that case, there was a professor and others, they've stopped. Of course, the Tamil Tigers are no longer, but they stopped having any relations with the PKK because of fear of being criminally charged. Yeah.
I just have a question for Sarah. When you went, you said that because your two companions had grandparents who were Palestinians, they were detained by the Israelis at the airport for 10 hours. But they were traveling with what, U.S. passports?
They're born and raised here.
So how did they know? I mean, they investigated them on computers or
whatever? No, one of the first, am I allowed to answer that question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We each went up individually, because of course you do that at customs, and one of the questions they were asked is, what is the origin of your last name? And they said, this is a Palestinian name, so you must have family here. And they said, no, we don't. Our parents were born, you know, elsewhere. We were born in the United States. And they go, no, but what's the origin of this last name? And they said, well, our grandparents were born and raised in this, you know, in Ramla, which is now in Israel. And as soon as they answered that question, they were immediately escorted to a detainment room. And to clarify, they weren't questioned for 10 hours. They were detained for 10 hours. So they would be asked like a series of a couple questions, and then they would be sitting in a room waiting for several hours. And then a different crew of people would come in, ask them the exact same questions, and then leave and then come back. So that's what happened.
Were they asked where they were planning to go, or who they were intending to see, or?
I can answer that question. I'm just making sure I can answer those kinds of questions.
You can answer.
Yeah, they were asked. Well, they were told actually repeatedly that they were lying and that they had to have family there. At one point, they were asked to list off every person they knew who was Jewish. They had Jewish friends. I mean, they were asked some really strange questions. They were asked where in Israel they were going, what hotel they were staying in, were they traveling to the West Bank, what was really the purpose of their trip, what were they trying to do. And they were labeled as almost terrorists themselves.
So they were sort of intimidated, to say the least.
Well, and they were exhausted, and they didn't get any food. And you know that airplane food sure isn't delicious. And so if you don't sleep and you don't eat for 10 hours, which neither of them did, and then you're detained for 10 hours, you only get water, I don't think I would have held up as well as they had.
Could you explain that this ruling about foreign terrorist organization also would apply to what the U.S. government calls state sponsors of terrorism, such as Cuba? Personally, I work on opposing the U.S. blockade of Cuba, and if they consider Cuba a terrorist state, then I would assume that I'm providing material aid to a terrorist state by opposing the blockade of Cuba.
I think the material support statute applies to It applies to foreign terrorist organizations. There's no language in there about state sponsorship of terrorism. Mm-hmm. So unless there's...
There's other laws that prohibit...
It's an organization.
Right, but these are... When the statute says organizations, it means like groups like the PKK or Hamas. It doesn't mean state entities.
CIA.
Yeah. Did you want to add something, Michael?
I mean, one interesting spin on this is, as some of you may know, there's money raised and sent and given to a lot of these settler groups in the occupied territories who carry out acts of terror against the Palestinians. And there actually are a couple of those groups on the list.
Okay.
Kush, you know, Meir Kahani was deceased, but his group. And I this is a little bit of far field, but I saw where there's this philanthropist, and they had a big thing out in California, and they raised $900,000 for the Israeli Defense Forces. But that's government. But there are non-government groups, Israeli groups or groups in Israel, who are on that list, but there's never been any effort to charge them or investigate them, as far as I know.
When you were questioned in Israel, mm-hmm. who questioned you?
Questioned at the airport?
Were the Israelis questioning you?
Yeah. At the airport, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't questioned for very long.
Why are you getting a request to be in front of the U.S. grand jury?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Well, they want to find out who sponsored her trip, where she was, where she went on her trip, who she met with on her trip.
They want us to name every individual we met in Palestine. I mean, they want every individual we know in the United States that does Palestine solidarity work. It's basically a name game.
You guys remember that question Michael read about tell me everywhere you went when you got back from Cuba, you know, so... It's the same deal we expect with this grand jury.
Good question.
Yeah, it's a good
I think it's very likely that Israelis are involved in some way in working with the U.S. in this investigation. That's all I can tell you right now.
I just want to make a couple comments. First, anyone can find out which foreign organizations are on the FTO list. All you have to do is Google Department of State in quotes, put down terrorist list, it'll bring you to a State Department website. There are 40 presently, as of November, 2 months ago, there were 47 quote FTOs. They're called, that's the acronym that's used, FTO. On that same page, I think there's something to the right, and you can get the list of the countries that are considered state sponsors of terrorism. There are four of them: Syria, Iran, Cuba, and Sudan. Those are the four, I believe. I don't know, I don't think there was a date with that, so I don't know how current that is. Is it known whether there are any other grand juries investigating political activists in any other U.S. jurisdictions at this time? What is the significance of the grand jury being out of this office, the Chicago office? And my third question is, what do you make of the fact that these raids and subpoenas followed so quickly after the June Supreme Court hearing? Thank you.
The grand juries are secret, and we don't know. I don't know if there's any other grand juries in any other cities investigating this or other related issues. It seems to me fairly obvious that the Supreme Court decision was a green light to go against people who have arguably any type of relationships around groups that they want to suppress. And this, what was the second question?
Why Chicago?
I'm speculating here. First of all, Chicago has Patrick Fitzgerald, who's got a big reputation when he was in New York as a fighter against terrorism. A lot of the people who are active in the Palestinian education and solidarity are in Chicago. And this AAAN, which is one of these organizations that works, is based in Chicago. So those are a combination of those things why it's in Chicago.
Each of you view the media coverage, or lack thereof, and then, which my view is, like, they're very sympathetic to government and Israeli policy, and how each of you view that in this process with your case, Sarah, and other solidarity activists or anti-war activists.
I think it depends on what media you're looking at. I think there's some articles that have come out that have brought up some of the First Amendment issues we've raised here today. You know, the corporate media is the corporate media. You know, they have their own priorities and perspectives on things, and sometimes we can get them to, you know, cover the constitutional issues that are involved in these sorts of cases, and sometimes we can't. So, you know, I guess that's all.
In regards to my case, it's not as interesting to get a piece of paper as it was for the first four, you know, a couple of the first 14 to have their homes raided. And so it's easier to sum that up in a couple minutes on mainstream TV than it is to explain why 23 people have been subpoenaed. And I think that's part of it, but I also think they don't think it's as newsworthy. I'm not sure.
Well, there has been a few good articles in the, I guess, alternative media in these times that have a very good article, and there's been articles about, on, you know, Huffington Post had an article, and alternative media and the blogs. I think it's very important for people to talk about this with other people, and that's why we're here, obviously, is to educate you and get your support. And this is a beginning of a situation that I think is going to continue for a while. And I think to the extent that people can voice their concern, write letters to the U.S. attorney, come to court when there is a court hearing, that's all going to make a difference.
Come out January 25th.
Yeah, right.
Understanding, obviously, that this is a legal matter, is there a role that Senator Durbin or your congressional representative can have here?
I know people have gone to see some of the congresspeople. Jan Schakowsky was visited, others. Usually what their response is, this is, like you said, this is a legal matter, the FBI is involved, and they do have a very limited role in trying to interfere in it or interject themselves. But we still think that all that kind of creates some kind of public concern that does echo and does filter down to those who have the power at this point.
So one more question.
What do you make of the connection between the activists and the Republican National Convention and the way many journalists were roughed up? Amy Goodman has a lawsuit. How do you tie this into, do you see this more with the Bush regime, or do you see this with Obama, or?
The best we can figure out the informant, the FBI informant, FBI agent, was placed in that organization, the Freedom Road organization, at the time of the Republican convention to, you know, report on and infiltrate efforts to protest. So that obviously was during the Bush era. But she continued on for 3 years. So her efforts continued through the Obama administration. I don't want to get into a long diatribe about this, but a lot of the Bush civil liberties policies have been continued, unfortunately, under the Obama administration. And some actually have gone further than Bush went himself. So the fact that we now have a Democratic administration has not, in my view, changed the trajectory of what they're about in terms of going after these people in Minnesota and Chicago.
Can I just add to that you know, Janet Napolitano and I believe Attorney General Holder have also commented on, you know, the old Bush policy was that we're going to fight the terrorists abroad so we don't have to fight them at home. And I believe both, you know, whatever that means, but both Napolitano and I believe Holder also have said that that view is outmoded. We're going to look at terrorism in the United States as well. So you can draw whatever conclusions you want from that, but I think it reinforces Michael's point that the civil liberties trajectory that the Bush administration was on is also the trajectory that the Obama administration is on. And remember, it was it was Kagan who brought this case to the Supreme Court, you know, Obama's appointee, not a Bush appointee.
Right.